Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our speaker tonight is Tim Lebrecht, who is the CMO at NBBJ and previously the chief marketing officer also at Frog Design. So our program this evening is The Unquantified Self, A New Era in Business and Technology. I'm going to turn it right over to Tim now. I'm not going to read a long biography. He speaks for himself. We do have his new book, The Business Romantic, which is a beautiful book, and I hope you'll buy one afterwards, but you're going to find out all about it tonight. With that, I'd like to introduce Tim Lebrecht.
Thanks, Kevin. Thank you. Hello, welcome. It's wonderful to be here. I am a business person, but I'm also an unapologetic romantic. I believe we need more romance in our lives, and I think we can find it and create it in and through business. Now, you might raise your eyebrows and wonder, like, romance and business, romance at work, what exactly do you have in mind? I'm not talking about office flirts with Joe and Susie in accounting. I'm also not talking about loving what you do or doing what you love. What I'm referring to is really the notion of romance in the spirit of traditional romanticism, the poets of the 18th and early 19th century. Those experiences of unexpected beauty and magic and awe and wonder that pushes out of our comfort zones, the little detours and digressions and the cracks of imperfection, those moments in which we lose control, moments in which we fall in love with the world, in fact, with everything. Music has taught me some valuable lessons about those romantic moments, about losing control. When I was 21, I joined a pop band called Migraine, very much to the delight of my parents. I dropped out of law school and pursued what turned out to be an utterly unsuccessful music career, maybe because of the choice of name or lack of talent. But it was a wonderful experience, and I learned a lot about creativity and collaboration. And I'm still really fondly remembering those days. Now I'm a marketer. I no longer write songs, I write memos, emails, presentations, proposals, business plans. But I'm still, in a strange way, I'm still singing my heart out, and I'm still looking for the same intensity of emotion in business that I felt when I was on stage as a musician. And the other business romantic coming of age formative experience that I had took place in the year 2004. When I worked as an advanced press chief for the Olympic torch relay leading up to the Athens Games. It was the first ever global torch relay, visiting 32 former Olympic host cities on the way to Athens. And also for the first time in history, African soil came to Cairo. And I was traveling with the torch, flew coach class, the whole thing felt like a presidential campaign. There were two guards that protected the flame. And the instructors had told us, whatever happens, the flame must never go out. And so I found myself on Tahrir Square. It was, in July, surrounded by thousands of cheerful Egyptians who were incredibly proud about the flame coming to their country, coming to African soil. It was hot. Sweat was dropping from my forehead. I had only eaten energy bars. And the sponsors were breathing down my neck while I was seeing the joy in the faces of the Egyptians. And I felt like I was at the heart of this tension, at this contradiction of the Olympics. There's a quote from the physicist Niels Bohr who says, "The sign of a great truth is that its opposite is also a great truth." And I think that statement very much applies to the contradiction of the Olympics. On the one hand, it's probably the most commercially exploited sports event after the World Cup that there is. At the same time, it's still the most romantic idea and endeavor imaginable. It's exactly how I felt, this tension between commerce and passion. And I realized back then that that intensity, that feeling, that tension is exactly what I wanted to have for the rest of my career. But then I came home to the Bay Area and my flame went out because I started working for an enterprise productivity software company in Marin, which is a great company. But I found myself in an office and had a real shock after this intensity of the campaign. And I was grappling with this insight that what can we do to keep our flames alight after the magic of the beginning is gone? What do we do when boredom creeps in and we find ourselves in this uncanny valley of routine, repetition, and boredom? the magic of the beginning gun, but not quite fully having reached the joy of mastery? Is there a sense for awe and wonder in business beyond perks and purpose? And this very much became the question of my career in the following years. And I realized that it might also be emblematic of a broader societal phenomenon. 100 years ago, the German sociologist Max Weber coined the term the great disenchantment to portray the pervasive regime of an increasingly intellectual, secularized, bureaucratic society driving spirituality out of our society into the margins of our lives. And I would argue that a century later, we are witnessing another age of great disenchantment, this time not propelled by industrialization, but by datafication, this growing accelerated quantification of everything. We're quantifying our marketplace, our transactions, our interactions, our relationships, our behavior. Welcome to the second machine age, where science fiction can hardly catch up with reality. So, typical day in the life today is we wake up with our Apple Watch, we use Fitbit to track our morning exercises, we take an Uber to work, where we use cloud to gauge our social influence on social media, we use Meeting Mediator to monitor social dynamics in meetings and other sociometric applications, and we even outsource our personal, most intimate relationships, from flirting to dating to mating to fertility to breakup to divorce. There's an app for it, really. There's even an app for our performance in bed. It's called Spreadsheets, data-based. And most recently, I've come across this app called Invisible Boyfriend. You can rent for $24.99 a month. You can rent an invisible boyfriend. Tagline is, a boyfriend your friends can believe in, who sends you fake text messages, fake email, and fake phone calls even. And very soon, we might fall in love with our operating system, as so beautifully depicted in the movie Her, maybe the most iconic movie of the past year. The film critic Manola Dargis wrote in the New York Times about the movie Her, the great question is not whether machines will be able to think. The great question is, will humans still be able to feel? And indeed, technology has domesticated our lives. Everything is familiar, convenient, automated, outsourced. So where do we find these profound experiences that punctuate our routines? Where is the unknown? Where are the strangers? Where's the magic? Smart algorithms and radical transparency and big data have given us more control, more convenience. But when everything is outsourced, automated, predictable, standardized, we leave no room for our magical, elusive, unquantified selves. We are at risk of engineering the romance out of our lives. Romance, the last luxury, maybe the ultimate retreat in a world of maximizers and optimizers. So what can we do? Some economists say, well, let's use those data tools, those quantitative tools, and apply them to different kinds of value. Let's start measuring different things that really matter. For example, well-being, purpose, meaning. We know that's incredibly important, increasingly important for millennials in particular, or happiness. But the logic remains the same. We use quantitative tools, we track them, we analyze, we aggregate, and then we maximize and we optimize. The writer and journalist Leon Wieseltier recently wrote, why do we turn to economists to become experts in happiness exactly? And why should algorithms teach us about morality and the right behavior? Case in point, the recent incident during the hostage crisis in Sydney. A couple of months ago, when Uber introduced surge pricing, so increased their fares, and that led to an outcry in the Australian public and beyond. People said that is really inappropriate, and Uber later had to apologize. The reason for why this happened is, well, it was an algorithm. It was an algorithm responding to growing demand, making the right logical decision, but maybe not the right humane decision at that point in time. Another example of so-called inadvertent algorithmic cruelty occurred when Facebook presented its very popular year in review feature last year, which usually presents a collection of highlights and blog posts and pictures of any given user. People usually like it, except there was one user who was suddenly reminded of the death of his daughter who died in the past year among all the cheerful icons. So again, it was an algorithm making a decision, an algorithm responsible for it. And it was the right logical thing to do, but in that very moment, it was without empathy, without sympathy. It's because algorithms can't suffer. Because they can't suffer, they can't love. They can't empathize. They can't feel sympathy. They can't feel compassion. They cannot give more than they take. In fact, they cannot withhold. They are utterly unromantic and probably not very humane in that regard either. So what I would conclude is that rather measuring different kinds of value, we have to begin to value what we cannot measure. In fact, we have to relearn to value what we cannot measure. We have to realize that some experiences are better if they are not optimized. We desperately need experiences for our elusive, longing, magical, erratic, inconsistent, incoherent, wondrous, awesome, unquantified selves. We need more romance in our life. Now, the good news is we've been there before. 200 years ago, the original romantic movement emerged in response to an age of reason and enlightenment. Keats, Wordsworth, William Blake, Lord Byron, and others. There's a great quote from the German poet Novalis, who said, "To romanticize the world is to make it aware of its magic, mystery, and wonder. It is to educate the senses to see the ordinary as extraordinary, the familiar as strange, the mundane as sacred, the finite as infinite." And I would argue that we are witnessing the beginning of a new romantic movement, this time in business, arguably the most important system of our lives. I think we're seeing a surge of experiences of business models that bring a notion of romanticism back into our missions, our campaigns, our businesses, our organizations. And with it, we see the rise of a new business persona, which I call the business romantic. Now, who is this mysterious business romantic? Well, let's start by identifying the enemies of the business romantic. The first enemy, enemy number one, is the cynic. The cynic who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing, as Oscar Wilde famously put it, who smells roses and thinks of a funeral, or as Donald Trump would say, it's business, it's not personal. Enemy number two is the data crunching, data evangelist, tech evangelist whom we occasionally encounter here in Silicon Valley. He or she relies solely on the objective truth of data and cherishes the principles of the book The Lean Startup, which has really emerged as a paradigm for business behavior over the past 5 years or so, a book written by Eric Ries. The Lean Startup is the anti-business romantic. When the Lean Startup proposes to pivot, the Lean Startup, the business romantic stays put and commits. When the Lean Startup wants to have a lean model of doing business, in fact, proposes a lean model of living, the business romantic wants to be thick and rich and intense. So the Lean Startup is the anti-business romantic. But I also created a positive vision of the business romantic, and I created a fictitious job description as I was writing this book. I wanted to test the market demand for the business romantic. And I put it on Craigslist and other job postings. And I want to read some of the attributes and the qualifications of the business romantic. We're looking for a self-starter with strong entrepreneurial drive, exquisite taste, and a proven track record of managing the immeasurable. Qualifications include, but are not limited to, doing things for no reason, taking part in joyous, aimless activities such as cloud spotting, mystery meetings, or result-free conversations, going on regular hikes with the CFO, providing leadership to other romantics at the workplace, ability to instantly fall in love with ideas, memes, and projects, ability to ignore big data and rely on big intuition instead, comfortable with high levels of ambiguity and unpredictability, comfortable with giving chance a chance, ability to have secrets and keep them, exceptional devotion to the unknown, fluent in English and German, romantic literature, experience in writing poems, a plus, sense of humor as appropriate. If you match this profile or are romantic in ways we could not imagine, we look forward to hearing from you. And then what happened was that I got more than 100 responses within the first week. Some of them obviously realized this is a fictitious job description and responded in a playful way, sent in poems and even drawings and made fun of it. But there were also responses and applications that took it quite seriously and sent me their resumes and really beautiful cover letters. And there was one letter from a woman who said, "I love this job. I really want to have this job, but I'm not going to apply because getting it would be utterly unromantic." And another person submitted their application and said, "This is beautiful. This really is my dream job. I want to have this job, but unfortunately and heartbreakingly, it's never going to exist in the real world," which I thought was quite sad. And I was thinking, why is that? Why do we give in to that? And why not envision an organization and a business world in which that sense of romanticism, that persona of the business romantic, has space and is possible? So I identified 10 romantic principles. I call them the rules of enchantment. And I want to share with you 3 today. Suffer a little, keep the mystique, and reconnect with something essential. I want to start with the rule, reconnect with something essential, because it's essential. Whenever there's a new season of the TV series Mad Men, a sense of nostalgia returns to our households as well. And nostalgia is really an evergreen in pop culture, maybe most vividly portrayed in the movie Casablanca, when Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman reassure each other of their exclusive prized possession: "We always have Paris." But nostalgia is often misunderstood as a longing for a time gone by, when in fact it comes from the Greek word nostos, which means old wound. And it rather describes an aching for a profound truth, something essential that we have forgotten, that we no longer can connect with, something essential. And there's a growing array of business models, products, and services that reflect that growing quest for nostalgic experiences, for some profound experiences. The maker movement is one of them. Another one is the rise of local artisans, each of which try to overcome the alienation between maker and product. Moleskine, the notebook maker, also is a very nostalgic product, and it has cherished the feature of emptiness, which is a real scarcity in a time of hyper-connectivity and constant chatter, absence, emptiness. Every notebook is an invitation to reimagine your life. Every blank page is an unwritten story and the romantic promise of starting all over again. There's also a rise of the curatorial. One particularly successful example is Maria Popova's site, Brain Picking. She calls it a human-powered machine for interestingness. So she celebrates subjectivity by sending her subscribers an assortment of articles chosen simply because she deems them worth reading. Not an algorithm. We crave these curatorial figures, these nostalgic old-fashioned concierges who offer us an escape from algorithmic recommendations or shared preferences and filters. Another example is the social network Elo, which has seen an explosive growth since it launched a few months ago. It positions itself as the anti-Facebook, where Facebook goes wide and wants to scale. Elo goes deep and intimate. It really heralds the purity, the intimacy of the experience. And it published a manifesto, something very nostalgic, with a set of values, which was certainly a strong part of its appeal. In the realm of professional social networking online, a startup named Somewhere is taking on LinkedIn. So LinkedIn is an accumulation of skills, of accomplishments. It's a progressive, linear representation of your career. The CEO of Somewhere says about LinkedIn, "It's basically a place where people you don't know endorse you for skills you don't have." And he says, "That needs to change. And we need to start treating work as a story, our identities as a story, as a narrative. We need a broader playing field, and more space for incoherent identities and for inconsistency. Also in the spirit of nostalgia, of reconnecting with something essential, is this resurgence of intimate, private dinner conversations with strangers. A notable example is the Death Over Dinner grassroots movement that has extended across the United States. It's essentially a conversation around a dinner table with strangers about the dignity of a good death. And Michael Hepp, the founder of this series, says, well, some people think that we don't want to have a conversation about death. That's not true. We just haven't gotten the right invitation yet. And he's sending them out. Then there are phenomena like the Springsteen Social Society in New York. It's a club, a secret society of sorts that gathers strangers at unexpected places in very raw, authentic, intimate settings. And then there's my absolute favorite, an application and web service called Forgotify that has made it its mission to discover and make available every single song on the music streaming service Spotify that has never been played. What is so interesting about this is, and so romantic, is that it's using algorithms to fight against algorithms, to fight against the narrow representation of a reality that is algorithm-based, to overcome what Eli Pariser calls the filter bubble. And it grants us with the romance and the intimacy that awaits us at the end of the long tail. Experiences that are beautiful because they can't scale and we don't want them to scale. The second rule of enchantment, the second romantic principle that I would like to introduce, is called keep the mystique. Now, in a time when transparency is the norm, in fact, radical transparency, mystery, not knowing, secrecy, make experiences meaningful again. When everything is open, nothing is open. So what do we choose to close? The UK-based startup Secret Cinema chooses not to disclose the movies that it's going to show. It essentially hosts so-called mystery screenings, not telling people what movie they're going to watch, at some remote, interesting locations. They are showing, for example, Shawshank Redemption or Grand Budapest Hotel in a hospital, even in a prison, in an immersive way of reenacting the movie. And what is so interesting about it is that Secret Cinema is turning the secret into the product, not knowing into the more powerful experience than knowing. That's also the principle behind the rise of anonymous sharing applications such as Whisper or Secret or Yik Yak, where users can exchange gossip and rumors and trade in the currency of doubt and identity trickery. And we've seen that they've become incredibly popular. Then secrecy is also part of the appeal of a new movement within organizations. Companies have begun to recognize the value and the power of those in their organizations who operate in the shadows of the business. Contrarians, secret change agents, rebels, they're given more space now, informal space than before. And at a greater scale, they're organized as collectives such as Rebels at Work or Corporate Rebels United or the League of Intrapreneurs. And secrecy, this aura of some kind of secret society, is a big part of their appeal. Now, a more explicit example of injecting disruption into our predictable routines and an aura of mystery is, of course, surprises. And it should come as no surprise that there is a business in New York called Surprise Industries that offers just that, surprise as a service, or as we in Silicon Valley would call it, SaaS. And it even touts a new category called surpriseology, offering surprises as a service to individuals and organizations. Another really beautiful example created by the performance artist Miranda July that disrupts our predictable routines and provides users with quite a surprise is an application called Somebody. Imagine you're in a restaurant and suddenly a man is approaching you with a cell phone, a smartphone in his hand, and then tells you, I have a message from Annie. I'm going to read it aloud. Please bring some milk home when you get home. Thanks, Annie. So what's happening, what's the principle of this application, is it lets you send text messages to recipients through users who are in physical proximity, really blending physical and virtual reality and injecting that shock, that surprise into your algorithmic and predictable reality. So nothing is more terrifying for a romantic than the thought of predictability and the lack of mystery. Romantics carve out these spaces where we don't know for certain, where we can see. So if you want to highlight something as a romantic, you hide it. Invite agents into your organizations. Create an underground in your businesses. Run some secret projects and mystery meetings. And make sure that mystery is present in all of your busy comings and goings. Now the last rule of enchantment is called suffer a little. And it's important to point out that romance is not identical with happiness. It's not easy. It's a labor of love. It's a lot of work. We have skin in the game. It can hurt. It's painful. You can suffer a little. That seems at first glance somewhat counterintuitive, because usually I think we hear all the principles of comfort is king, convenience is the mother of all user experiences. Look at Uber and other business models. Instant gratification is what we're all after. And yet, and soon Amazon will deliver everything we desire to our doorsteps via drone. But at the same time, why is it that we camp out in front of Apple stores days before the launch of new products, defying bad weather? Why is it that we wait in line in front of very popular bakeries in San Francisco for 30 minutes just to get a croissant, which is arguably pretty good, but you could also get elsewhere? Why is it that we climb up the mountain plateaus of the Alps for a day or so just to see the leading bikers of the Tour de France ride by for 10, 15 seconds? Why is it that 50,000 people embark on an annual pilgrimage to the Burning Man Festival in the Black Rock, Nevada desert to celebrate the barter economy, this festival of radical self-expression, this opportunity to lose control of ourselves for a week? When you talk to evolutionary psychologists, they will tell you, our brains are still wired for the Stone Age. We're still wired to compete. We're still looking for the existential threats, the critical events that give our lives meaning, that prove our fitness, that assess our fitness in existential situations. Now, in our Western societies, we have all but banned these existential threats. We just don't face them anymore. But we're still craving for that meaning that we derive from them. So what do? We turn to bungee jumping, we run ultra marathons, skydiving, and other things. Or we go to IKEA. IKEA has perfected the art of suffering. It has perfected the art of frustrating its customers. If you've ever tried to buy an Oslo or Clip-On piece of furniture, first of all, the parkour itself is the seventh circle of hell. And then when you finally successfully made it home, assembling it, at least if you're me, is really a painful exercise in sacrifice. It's a testament of your own existential incompetence. There's research about it. It's called the IKEA effect. A Journal of Consumer Psychology published a study that talks about the labor of love, proving that if you suffer a little, you have, of course, a stronger emotional attachment to products and a stronger loyalty going forward, which is also the reason, by the way, and the design principle behind loyalty programs. Forget about instant gratification. We never, never, never cash in on these. It's delayed gratification. It's the romantic promise of permanent unfulfillment that propels us and makes us want to be a member of these loyalty programs so much. And this principle of frustration is part of the equation. This principle of suffering a little bit has also been adapted by other businesses. Zappos, for example, is very interesting in that regard, that it makes it harder for applicants to apply for a job when every other organization makes it as easy as possible to apply. Zappos has a network that you have to register for first. You have to enroll and then converse with existing employees, build some institutional knowledge, then you're eligible to apply for a job, suffering a little bit. Suffering also means really pushing ourselves out of our comfort zone. And what is scarier than the thought of talking to a stranger, especially on the commuter train? But interestingly, research conducted at the University of Chicago recently showed that if you talk up strangers, you chat up strangers on the train, you report higher levels of happiness. And it proves that those micro interactions, those random, seemingly random micro interactions that we have with strangers, have a huge effect on our happiness in our lives. So if you ever have a conversation with a barista or the taxi driver, if it's positive, it might make your day. If it's negative, it might destroy your day, although it is a very small interaction with a stranger. And you can take that principle also to the business environment. At the company that I used to work for, Frog Design, we forced that intimacy, we forced that strangeness by conducting a so-called speed meet, where new employees had to meet for 3 minutes existing employees and get to know them. It was slightly uncomfortable, but also a very rewarding, thick and intense experience. You could even take it one step further and summon mystery meetings, where you're summoned to a meeting where you don't know the people who are in the room, you don't know the topic that you're going to present about, and you might in fact be in the same room with the CEO. That pushes you out of your comfort zone, but it makes the familiar strange again and romanticizes work. The scariest thing, however, is to be alone. Nothing is more terrifying than to be alone with our thoughts. There has been a study that I found quite shocking, which showed that we would rather feel mild level of pain, in fact receive mild electroshocks, than being alone with our thoughts. And it's interesting to counter that with some practices in business that take cues from the arts, really going for intense experiences that are not thinly distributed but thickly present, as the writer Anand Giridharadas calls it. So one example from the arts that we can learn from is the 24-hour interview marathon that takes place every year at the Serpentine Gallery, or this really wonderful performance that Marina Abramovic, the performance artist, performed at the MoMA as part of her exhibition. The artist is present for almost 800 hours. She sat across from visitors for, I think, for 4 or 5 minutes each and just looked them in the eye. And then there is an experiment that Priya Parker and Anand Giridharadas, friends of mine, conduct in New York. It's a social experiment. They call it I Am Here Days. And together with a group of friends, they spend a whole Sunday once a month in New York City exploring a new neighborhood. They get rid of all the digital devices. There's no distraction. They to commit to being fully in the moment, being fully present, which is very, very hard because there are moments during the day that are incredibly boring. The conversations peters out. But the insight behind it is that you forge stronger bonds if you spend 8 hours with people than 8 times 1 hour. And Anand Giridharadas calls this thick presence. And so often in our world, we are thinly distributed. Just think about the conference calls we have where there's 10 or 15 people on the call. We hang up frustrated because, again, we couldn't get a word in. There was really no outcome. And then we regroup again 2 weeks from now where we rehash the last 30 minutes of the previous meeting. How much more interesting, how much more romantic, how much thicker would the experience be if we locked ourselves into a room with one person for a whole day without distractions, talked about everything, of course the work as well, and fleshed out a project. Thick presence at the workplace. So suffering a little bit can reinvigorate the romance in our lives and at the workplace. And there's really nothing more terrifying to a romantic than a life of complete ease and convenience. So make your customers and employees suffer a little bit. Frustrate them so that they value what they cannot get and reap the ultimate reward, the desire intact, the thrill not gone, permanent unfulfillment. So these are the three romantic principles, the three rules of enchantment that I wanted to introduce today. Reconnect with something essential, keep the mystique, and suffer a little. And they show what I believe is a broader shift that we're seeing from a smart, connected age to a new romantic age. Ephemerality over permanence, ambiguity over clarity, serendipity over predictability, generosity over efficiency, inconsistency over reliability, danger over data, subjectivity over objective truth, and the unquantified self over the quantified self. And the shift from the smart to romantic age, I think, takes place in marketing, in HR, in business strategy, across the entire spectrum of the business landscape and beyond. The smart connected age was all about accumulating as much knowledge as possible in the sense of the quantification of everything, knowing as much as possible in order to react almost in real time, to adapt to ever-changing circumstances, to be part of the conversation and reconfigure your business model. The romantic age has different preferences, different priorities. It's all about mystique and intrigue and not transparency. It's about vulnerability, not calculated risk. It's about love, not liking. It's about frustration, not efficiency or user-friendliness. And it's about significance and not just excellence. So go and romanticize. That would be my call for action. Do not only solve a problem, create space for friction, and extend the territory beyond the map. Use data to mystify, not to demystify. I'm not against data, but I think we can use it in a way that is romantic and not just efficient. I think you have the power and the responsibility to defend and nurture what is a bulwark against the extreme engineering mindset, the commodification, the quantification, the disenchantment of the world. Fight for your right to romance. It's a human right. And we romantics don't aim to make things more useful. We just want to make them more beautiful. We don't want to answer all of our questions or solve all of our problems or cure all of our pain. We just want to make them worthwhile. We don't even want to necessarily do good. We just want to feel more. Business is our ultimate adventure. I want to leave you with a quote from the romantic poet William Wordsworth, which is a modern version of Nike's Just Do It. To begin, begin. So how? Whether you're a card-carrying business romantic or romantic already, whether you're a cynic or you are a closet romantic, you can start using the word romance and romanticizing in a business context in a positive way and challenge those who use the term romanticizing to dismiss emotions, feelings. You can join the Business Romantic Society, a secret society if you just email me. or you can apply some of the rules of enchantment in your job tomorrow and see what happens. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Tim Lebrecht, who's speaking here tonight on the Unquantified Self. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. We are going to now be turning it over to Tim for this, but I'd like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. So we are going to now turn it over for questions and answers. Tim, I'm going to ask the first question. How can we actually apply this directly in our lives? It sounds great. Sounds wonderful. It was a wonderful presentation, but how can we actually take a pragmatic approach to being a business romantic and go tell our boss to light soften up?
Are you being a cynic, Kevin? The question is, so how can you be a business romantic without going broke, really?
That's it.
And that's a very fair question. But I think there's too much at stake. There is obviously a human argument to be made. We want to have meaningful, rich lives. And studies show that the typical knowledge worker spends up to 70% of his or her waking hours at work. So between the top line and the bottom line, there's a lot of moments that matter that add up to the whole narrative and journey of your life. So don't you want that life to be more meaningful, more romantic, and not just happening within the narrow confines of business pragmatism? That's one reason. But I think there's also an economic argument that we could make for business romanticism, which is that a Gallup survey from the year 2013 showed that only 13% of employees are fully engaged. And those numbers are not new. So there's a huge economic cost for organizations who have employees under their roof, who are not fully committed, who are not devoted. And we know that intrinsic motivation is so much more powerful than coercion or compensation even. And so there is an economic reason for organizations as well to at least enable a culture of romanticism. And the book is not challenging an economic paradigm or the principles of the market economy. What it's trying to do is to propose a few very humble, small tweaks, hacks, if you will, of the workplace and beyond that allow you to see the world, as Marcel Proust would say, with fresh eyes, the world of business with fresh eyes. So you can reframe it. You can create a different narrative, even though the encounters you have or the logic is the same. So it's an attempt to inject romanticism and a very subversive notion of romanticism, if you will, through the back door. And I think we are all capable of doing that.
And is there a special food we need to eat at work, like a madeleine, to help us do that?
I don't know. I'm not a foodie, unfortunately, despite the great cooking skills of my wife.
But you're a Proustian. So, okay, next question.
Hi, Tim. Thank you. It was fantastic. So this is actually related to the last question, which is about anxiety and control. My experience is that the resistance to what you're talking about really, I think, is related to there's a lot of anxiety, which drives us to become fixated on metrics and quantification. As someone who is actually trying to make a living as a romantic researcher, you know, this is an uphill battle. And I know that you've worked in the industry, and you've probably had to pitch and persuade and, you know, so I'd really like to understand more about how can we work with that, the anxiety and what we're, you know, inviting people to lose a little bit of control and how threatening that can feel.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. Well, first of all, the things that I describe in the book are probably more pertinent to the knowledge worker. I think it's important to acknowledge that the kind of freedom or autonomy you need to have over your schedule and the type of work certainly do not apply to many workers out there in different industries, so who don't even have the choice of reframing and the autonomy to do so that many of us, I think, here have. In terms of anxiety, yeah, absolutely. And I worked for a company that was owned by a private equity firm, big private equity firm, and I was in boardroom meetings where I felt that logic of the numbers, it was very palpable to me, and I had numerous encounters, even working for a creative firm, where whoever had the numbers won, right? You don't have the data, you don't have the numbers, we're not going to listen to you anymore. And there are certain terms like romanticizing, love, passion, that are usually used to dismiss or denigrate proposals. So it is hard. I'm not saying, sort of dreaming of a naive, a different world of business. But I think if we all just make small adjustments, I think they add up to a greater narrative. When I was working for a creative company, for example, we hosted an opening party for South by Southwest Interactive every year. And it was absolutely remarkable because there was really no sound business reason to do it, to be honest, I can now say. but every year we did it because people were so passionate about it. And we never quantified the value it created in terms of goodwill with the community of Austin or the motivation of our people. But every year we had this discussion. It's like, oh, God, it's another, you know, it's really, we could use the money otherwise for targeted BD pursuits. Should we really do it? And every year we said, oh, of course. It was a romantic decision. We gave more than we took. And in hindsight, even though we didn't have the tools and the appetite to measure it back then, in hindsight, it was one of the things that made that organization so special and so unique. We didn't appreciate it. We didn't know it even at the time. Now I know it even better. And I think if you look at your businesses, you can find these examples. And you can have a stronger voice and make a stronger case for them, even though you might not have the numbers. So it has to do with leaps of faith a little bit, and not just having the numbers to back it up.
Hey, Tim. Thank you, Chris. You started talking about what I was going to ask is, what are some of the things that you have done in your business life that we might emulate, you know, amplifying the positive? You're a wonderful positive example in front of us. What can we do? You got MBBJ, a very romantic on one hand, but very rational, great group on the other hand. So what have you done there?
Yeah, thank you. I don't know. It's my own track record is all that romantic. I think what I've done is that I also always considered being in business as almost like playing in a band. And I always worked in marketing, and I always had this feeling I was a member of a band. It goes back to my music, my half music career that I pursued. And for example, at Frog Design, we had a magazine called Designment, which still exists. It's a great magazine, and we always had to fight about mentioning the brand, the sponsor on it, and some of my former colleagues are here. It was always a fight to say, no ads, and no, we don't even want to mention Frog. Frog should not be on there at all.
We actually want to have an authentic relationship with people who read it. We don't want to use it to advertise. The goodwill we create is much more important than the transactional nature of this relationship. And there were other examples when it comes to events, when it comes to publications, when it comes to some business decisions, where you make decisions that seem unreasonable, but you feel very strongly about them because you know at the core they're the right decisions. They feel true. And they have to do with your integrity. And those moments when I felt like an artist, so I didn't just deliver on demand, and I didn't just cater to a need, but I actually created something without knowing exactly what was going to happen to it, those were the best moments that I had in my career. And interestingly enough, many companies are desperate to harness these moments because those are very moments that create innovation, right? It's innovation is a leap of faith. We never know what's going to happen. And then many companies use all these tools and they try to reconfigure and recreate the conditions for innovation when in fact they only had to rely and trust the people who are really creative and artistic in their thinking.
Thank you very much for sharing those stories. This is Evan over here. Now, as far as, can you describe any paradigm-shifting moments where your awareness of this concept of business romantic really came to clarity?
There was one moment I was sitting at the airport in New Delhi, and for 1.5 years I was the CMO of a private equity-owned engineering outsourcing firm, an IT services firm with I think 10 or 12,000 employees in Bangalore, Gurgaon, New Delhi, but also here in the States. And I had come there to help integrate two different cultures, the creative culture of a design firm with the engineering mindset of that larger firm. And I was attracted to this mission because it was a mission impossible. It was this Don Quixote quest of like, well, you know, in my hubris, I'm going to make it happen. And I didn't. I think in hindsight, it was a failure, and I was probably somewhat arrogant going in there trying to preach the gospel of creativity to a number of very seasoned engineers. But there was this one moment when I was sitting at the airport, and I realized that the mission had failed. I was clinking glasses with my colleagues, and he said, to a dream. To a dream that failed, and I said, to a dream. It was a beautiful moment. It felt like Casablanca. But I realized that I actually had a really, really great time. Although it was hard, and there was a lot of politics. It was a hard mission to be on. But I had an amazing time because I learned so much, and I had put myself into a position where I stretched myself, where I was taken out of my comfort zone. It was an adventure, and I had this intensity of emotions again that I felt almost like during the Olympic torch relay campaign. And that was probably a seminal moment for me when I realized, well, if it's possible for me, how can we create conditions for this intensity? Why are we not cherishing this more rather than just filing it a professional failure or a tenure that didn't lead to tangible outcomes necessarily? So I think that was an inflection point for me.
So, Tim, as you know, as a design computation specialist who's been sort of caught up in the Silicon Valley tech world as well over the last year, the idea of data-driven decision-making has been in the forefront of my life recently. But I'm also one of these subversive characters. You might not know this yet. But I sent a tweet just last week that was literally, I used to write poetry, I used to make films, I used to pursue photography. Now I use computers. Hashtag sadness. So my question to you is just a little bit cheeky, but hopefully we'll set you up to answer it in the way that a romantic, only a romantic can. And that is that now that you are bringing this message that resonates quite well with me and hopefully lots of other people, now that you're on this whirlwind book tour and bringing this message and talking about ushering in a new age of romanticism, how do you quantify whether or not that effect is having the effect that you intend?
It's funny, I this came from Berlin where when I launched a book project, I had an inner circle of advisors, and And we did a workshop for one day. We did an intense lab and talked about questions related to romanticism and meaning at the time. And one of my friends said, well, what we should do is a meaning index. Right? That's it. We should do a meaning index to quantify what really is meaningful for us. And I thought about it and said, first I said, yeah, sure, let's do that. And then a few days later, I think I had the courage to say, no, that's the exact opposite of what I have in mind. That's the exact opposite. I am all for the beauty of things that don't scale. And there is value in quantifying things, for sure. There's value in measuring things. But there are some experiences in life, and even within the business world, that are just beyond measurement, and that we shouldn't measure, because if we measure them, we make them smaller than they are in terms of their expressiveness and their meaning for us. So I would say we have to find the right language. We have to use data and technology, and we can, to create some kind of smart romanticism. We can create romantic experiences with technology, but I don't think we need to come up with an index. And so many of these, as you probably know, are very arbitrary anyway. I mean, show me the return on investment design index that has become a universal metric. It's still a pretty lofty affair. But I do want to comment on the dichotomy between poetry and computation. I don't think it's quite interesting that there's a school of poetic computation in New York, for example, whose motto it is less demo, more poetry. So they actually encourage their students to build applications and devices that mystify and that enchant. There's also Enchanted Objects, a book by, I think it's David Rosen is his name, the author, who talks about how the Internet of Things can contribute to an enchantment of the world. And then there are applications such as Forgetify, which I think is quite beautiful. So there is, I'm not against technology, and I think there are ways to use technology in a different way. I think it's just a matter of the right mindset and how we employ these tools, not eliminating them from our lives. Way too late for that.
And also, I believe when we talk about quantification, we forget about time. And if you factor in the time, even if one person leaves from here, it's like the ripple effect. You never know. So it's like planting the seeds. You don't see right away the crops, right? But so time, it takes time. And this is that's what we are missing in quantifications. It's like a static, not a process.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, time is a metric. And whenever we go through, in all of our organizations, through 2, 3, 4 month long planning cycles and budget conversations for the next fiscal year, it always strikes me as somewhat arbitrary, right? It's this 1 year that we cut out when, in fact, the sales cycles and the life cycles of organizations follow very different patterns and metrics. So it's this superimposed artificial metric to begin with in business.
Hey, Tim, Arthur Nelson. I'm going to push you just a little bit harder, respectfully. How do you actually scale romanticism? And I ask that question because I think everybody can come to terms with working on a really great, a really small project team, or having been at a startup, or you're at a company that's 50 people, now it's 5,000 people. There's a problem of scale and just the connectedness and romanticism being lost once you hit this threshold of humans interacting with other humans. So how do you scale everything that you just talked about?
Well, first of all, the original romantic movement did scale, interestingly enough. So there were enough voices to really turn it into a movement, although it was a very individualistic collective to begin with. But it became a movement, and some of these tropes survived until today. Arguably, it's easier for a startup, when you're in the you have this level of intimacy, you work together, there's this intensity of shared striving. There's more human interaction, so you have more. It's easier for you to have these experiences than, say, for GE or Cisco or another Fortune 500 company. But I think that the tools that I describe, whether they are creating moments of strangeness, swapping roles, the thick presence I talked about, dinner conversations instead of meetings, and other specific techniques that I propose, I think they're equally applicable for Fortune 500 organizations. GE did a training, an empathy training for its middle managers a few years ago. And I think there is a recognition that just the typical business processes and the tools are no longer enough. And that, in fact, I mean, it's interesting that so many employees go to Burning Man, even with their colleagues, or go to summer camp to have that level of experiences. So the more organizations can enable that and create the conditions for that, I think the more it can scale. I would caution us, though, And that's maybe the tension at the heart of this idea, not to over-formalize it. So the moment the CEO says, well, this year's theme is romanticism, we run the risk of squeezing the life out of it, right? It's then, I think, it's the scale also might eliminate the very essence of romance. So I think leaders can create the conditions for it and reward it, and reward the entrepreneurs, the rebels, the contrarians organizations, give them more space, give them a voice without formalizing business romanticism through a number of policies and processes that are then measured, quantified, and tracked over a one-year cycle, because I think that would probably create the opposite. So it's a more my notion is more subversive than it is proposing a comprehensive paradigm that is a revolution in business. I don't think that's what I have in mind.
Yes, I thought at the beginning that we are talking extroverts versus introverts. I think introverts have a better shot at this. And the reason for this, I think it's probably like an introspection. And the beginning is from within, to get in touch with your feelings and being able to express your needs, unmet needs. And that's where romanticism starts. And
yeah, I think both extroverts and introverts, but introspection, I hope extroverts are capable of introspection as well, is certainly the beginning.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached a point in our program where we have time for only one more question and a brief wrap-up. So I'm going to take, since I have the microphone, I'm going to take this opportunity to ask you a question and then ask you to give us some closing statements. So Tim, I first knew you when you were chief marketing officer at Frog Design. And so there's this whole kind of design thinking that we hear about with IDEO and with Frog and strategy and innovation and design. Now you're the chief marketing officer for a leading architectural firm. How has that affected your thinking, and how does design thinking come into architecture, come into these other worlds, and what can we take away from your experience?
Well, design thinking has been very important to me because it really is a departure. It was one of the most prominent departures from traditional business thinking. When I arrived at Frog, it was 2006. That was the first organization I worked for where I realized, wow, wow, a different way of doing business is possible, surrounded by creative people. And Frog was very interesting in many ways, incredibly creative, incredibly passionate, also very self-governed. So a lot of contrarians, a lot of rebels there. I learned how to trust and to deal with ambiguity. I think there was a saying at Frog, you have to be the water, not the rock. So there was no formal career path. There weren't even job titles sometimes. It was really what you made it. NBBJ, the architectural design firm that I work for now, is similar but also very different. What I like about NBBJ is the impact that you can have with the built environment. It's amazing the impact you can have on people's lives if you build hospitals or headquarters or urban spaces. And what is particularly interesting about MBBJ is that it occupies the space between data quantification, which is increasingly becoming important through design computation in architecture, not just for the facades or for the design, but also just for understanding human behavior within those buildings. And there's a lot of value to that. But at the same time, it is about beauty. And there is an artistic impulse, and there is something inexplicable about what distinguishes a building that is beautiful and that people rave about from a building that is just mundane and boring, right? And I think as long as we're not able to fully grasp that and quantify it, I want to be in that business.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'd like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kevin O'Malley, Chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum, your host for tonight. Our speaker tonight has been Tim Lebrecht, CMO of NBBJ, former CMO at Frog Design. Our program tonight was The Unquantified Self, A New Era of Business and Technology. And Tim, with that, would you please give us a brief tweeted kind of closing statement to not be cynical? I hope
that this inspires you to go back to your work tomorrow and just think about a different framing, first of all, of the typical experiences you have. And then maybe you start these small little experiments. You talk to a stranger on the commuter train. You rearrange your seats. You go out to lunch with someone you've never had lunch before. You swap roles. You spend a day with someone. You create a little bit of a secret society. You do a mystery meeting. Maybe instead of tracking your fitness runs, you keep a diary. You write a poem as a bookend to your project. You apply all these things that make your life and business more poetic and more romantic. And I think if we all do this, I think we can actually have an impact, and maybe we can even scale this notion of business romanticism. Well, thank you. It's been really great to be here tonight.
Thank you, Tim Lebrecht. Thank you to our audience here at the Commonwealth Club of California. Thank you to our audience listening at home. My name is Kevin O'Malley, and with that, I will close this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 125 years of enlightened public discussion.